Good afternoon. I'd like to call the House Labor and Commerce Committee to order. Today is Friday, February 2nd, 2024. Let the record reflect the time is 3:16 p.m. Today we have present Representative Sadler, Representative Crox, Representative Wright, Representative Carrick, Representative Fields, and myself, Chair Sumner. The staff would be assisting us today are Kevin Allen with House Records, Zachary Lawhorn with the LIO, and Clark Bickford, my staff and committee aide to House Labor and Commerce. Today in committee, we have four items on the agenda: House Bill 147, House Bill 186, House Bill 192, and finishing up with Senate Bill 37. Starting with House Bill 147, I'd like to invite Representative Dibert and her staff to approach the committee, put your name on the record, and begin your presentation. And for the record, we do have invited testimony from Rebecca Zavarel, principal of Denali Elementary School, and Sean Prince, principal of Bartlett High School. Representative, you want to begin?
Mr. Chair and esteemed members of the committee, for the record, my name is Maxine Dibert. I'm representative for District 31, downtown Fairbanks. I extend my sincere gratitude for this opportunity to address you today regarding House Bill 147. In the course of my duties as a representative, I frequently engage in school visits within my district and across regions of Alaska. These visits serve as a chance to engage with students about the responsibilities of an Alaska legislator and the legislative system. And it offers them the chance to ask many questions. Moreover, such visits afford me the invaluable opportunity to connect with educators throughout our state, engaging in discourse over pertinent issues that they encounter. Without fail, upon entering a new school, I'm greeted by signs adorning the front doors that say they're searching for substitute teachers. Signs that often say, please call, apply now. Conversations with school principals invariably reveal a pressing need for additional substitutes to fill in for teachers on leave or to temporarily occupy teaching positions until a permanent replacement has been secured. It's a sentiment echoed by many school administrators statewide. The quintessential substitute is a required teacher who's intimately familiar with the school's dynamics, its students, families, parents, and support staff in the buildings. Consequently, retired teachers are often the first individual school districts call upon when the need arises. And more often than not, they graciously answer that call. Allow me to share an anecdote from my recent visit to a school in the heart of my district, downtown Fairbanks, called Ryan Middle School. There, I had the pleasure of encountering Mrs. Rayfield, who, when I ran into her, Mrs. Rayfield was my seventh grade teacher at Ryan Middle School, actually. She revealed, when I asked what she was doing there, she revealed to me that she was there to sub for a long-term position, and for a teacher that was on maternity leave. And her return to the classroom, albeit temporary, reignited her passion for teaching, particularly because her wealth of experience enabled her to connect with middle schoolers. And her exact words were, I understand middle schoolers. I just get it. I love being here. Something I'm sure the rest of many of us can't honestly say. House Bill 147 seeks to accomplish two pivotal objectives. First, it endeavors to eliminate one financial barrier hindering retired Alaska teachers from obtaining a lifetime retired teaching certificate, a prerequisite for assuming long-term substitute roles. Presently, the cost of this certificate stands at $240, an expense we aim to waive as an incentive Secondly, the bill proposes an extension of the maximum duration for long-term substitutes holding the certificate, increasing it from 120 days to 165 days of consecutively working in the schools. Additionally, this bill addresses the pressing needs of school districts statewide, aiding in the acquisition and retention of substitute teachers, thus easing the burden on our schools in locating experienced teachers. And in conclusion, Mr. Chair, House Bill 147 represents a symbiotic solution, incentivizing our retired educators to return to the classroom while bolstering the educational landscape in Alaska. I urge you to consider its merits earnestly and endorse its passage for the betterment of our schools and our communities. Thank you for your time, Chair and Committee. And Mr. Chair, if it pleases the committee, I have my staff member, Tammy Smith, on my right, here to go over the sectional for House Bill 147.
Please go ahead. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chairman Sumner and Committee. For the record, I am Tammy Smith, staff for Representative Dybert, and I'm going to provide a brief sectional analysis for you. In Section 1, Line 3, this refers to eliminating the $240 fee for a retired lifetime teacher certificate. Also, in Section 1, Line 9, this increases the number of consecutive days that a retired lifetime certified teacher is allowed to sub from 120 days to 165 days. So this concludes the sectional analysis. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Committee, and I am happy to answer any questions.
Okay, I think we'll take a round of questions, and then we'll go to invited testimony, and then maybe another. Representative Fields.
Thank you, through the chair. This does seem very logical. I'm only curious why we would have any limit on the number of consecutive days. Thank you.
Through the chair, Representative Fields, one of the reasons why we moved it from 165 days, let me just give a little bit of background on that. Not too long ago, in like 2016, 2017, at one time, you could only sub in a long-term sub position for up to 20 days. They changed that to 120 to just allow for a greater length of time for a long-time certified teacher to be in the classroom consecutively. Part of that has to do with the amount of pay that is allowed in a position that has a substitute teacher in it. So the change from 165, we really wanted to incentivize the district to, first of all, go for or do everything that they can possibly do to hire a new active certified teacher. It is the intent of this bill to always ensure that they're looking for the teacher that is just either coming on board or possibly coming into a school district that at that time of the year. In addition, we wanted to, we looked at how schools hire people, and typically in the first 3 weeks of a school year, there's a lot of movement. You know, teachers are being placed in certain classrooms. There might be some classrooms that may be consolidated, and they have to actually, you know, move teachers and then determine at that time whether or not they have enough teachers for a specific district. What we wanted to ensure more than anything is to encourage districts to go in that direction first and not to put in a retired substitute teacher.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Wright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, through the chair. The bill sponsor, I imagine that teachers are on a fixed, or retired teachers are on a fixed income, and that's why you want to do this?
Through the chair to Representative Wright. The reason why I want this bill to move forward is because our schools are in dire need of substitutes. So the schools came to me, is there any way that we could get subs into the schools? And my testimony, my add a little bit more to this. But schools need subs, and having this retired lifetime certificate is an incentive to get retired teachers into the schools. Do what you like to add.
I would like to just say that in answer and specific response to if they are on a fixed income, they certainly are. If I may add a little bit and through the chair, as we are looking at the lifetime certified teacher, like I currently am, while I'm retired, I am still active. I still have an active certification. Your lifetime certified teacher that we are looking at are people that have, decided not to renew their active certification. And they're probably even a little bit older than I am. And so they may have given that up. And then this is an opportunity for them to reignite, like Mrs. Rayfield, who's probably been retired several years, to come back and support these communities.
Thank you.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Got a couple questions, but the first question I look at, my understanding is this is actually for either the sponsor or your staff, that 180 instructional days is kind of a full year's teacher workload. So, and 165 days is darn near all the way there. And if a teacher did want to work that many days out of the year, under what circumstances would they retire and then want to go back as a darn near full-time long-term sub?
Through the chair, that's a good question, and I even had to think about that. But again, it would be somebody like, I'm just going to use myself as the example. If I let my certification lapse, and if I don't do anything about it, it will lapse in 2 years. And part of renewing a certification is you have to go back, you have to get a certain number of credits, and there's a process through that. And sometimes getting those credits can be a lot of money. Then you have to apply for the application. What we're looking at here is not the active substitute, like maybe perhaps I could be if I still wanted to be. We're actually looking at someone who is a little bit beyond that. And I may have forgotten part of your question if I didn't answer that completely.
Thank you, Chair. You're getting to most of it. Again, I actually asked what the cost is, but if someone wanted to teach most of full-time, why would they retire? And you may have answered some of the question, and there might be an expense in maintaining a full-time certificate. What would that expense be?
Well, in order for me to maintain my certificate, I have to have 6 continuing credits, and they have to be at a certain level, like the 500 or 600 level credit. And actually, when you're working for a district, sometimes you can take a credit from the district through their programs and whatnot that are sometimes a little bit less expensive because they can offer a number. I actually am looking now at having to recertify and kind of looking at taking credits that are even a little bit more expensive because I no longer am a part of a school district. So there is that. But the other thing in regards to why, if you were not hired like as a long-time certificated active teacher, is the substitute teacher in that retirement position, they do have a little bit of a less responsibility, quite frankly. And I think, I don't know that I would ever want to go back to that position as being a active certified teacher. They're just because more than anything, it's kind of a young people's game, quite frankly. And the other thing is we really want to encourage districts to always be looking for an early career educator or someone that may be just right out of the classroom.
If you have a dollar amount of what it costs to roughly to get the credits and to pay the fee, and the second part I'll ask just briefly, about what percentage of the current teachers in Alaska are working as substitutes? I have heard that it's difficult for districts to find substitute teachers and that there's a lot of reliance on them. Just help me understand how much of their workload they're fulfilling.
So I'll answer your first question with regards to how much it's going to cost. Again, if I were taking the 6 credits, it could be anywhere from $600, because per credit hour, I have to have 6 credit hours. So per credit hour, it may be, if I'm lucky, it's going to be only $100 per credit hour. If I am looking at something a little more, depending upon which course that I want to take, it may be $200 or $300 for a credit. So if you need 6 of them, minimally that's $600. It could be well up to $1,000. That's just for the coursework. That's not including the fees for the licensure or certification.
Which is how much? To the chair. I'm still trying. How much is that certificate, licensure?
Through the chair, currently it's $240 for just the certificate. And to answer your second question, if I may, we do have deed on the line to answer the question that you had with regard to how many teachers may be substituting.
Well, and I suppose if we could hear from deed on that, that'd be great. I don't see anybody on the line. I assume you can get back with the committee on that.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Representative Carrick? Thank you.
Thank you. Through the chair, I really appreciate this legislation because as a young sub in the district, I really benefited from a retired teacher coming back to sub and also help mentor. So I think it's a really valuable tool. I was just curious, though, as we're removing in this legislation the one-time fee, just curious if that was something you heard feedback on as being a barrier, or is it more just that this is kind of an unnecessary obstacle and we're removing it? Or maybe it's both. So just wondering if you could add a little bit more to that.
Through the chair to Representative Carrick, we didn't hear anything specific that there was a barrier to this. However, I will say this. Again, there is a pretty significant difference between someone who is just retired and still has an active certification versus someone who has retired and has been retired 4 or 5 years. The likelihood of them wanting to go through that process is decreased, and that is pretty significant. So I would say if that was a barrier, it may be.
Thank you. Representative Prox.
Thank you, Chair Sumner. Through the chair, I guess I'm not familiar with the licensing requirements, but I'm guessing that a certified teacher has to be recertified every couple of years or something like that. Is that correct?
Through the chair, to Representative Prox, yes.
Okay. And Paula, so does this retired licensed teacher, I forget the name of what we're doing here, related to teacher certificates for retired teachers, would they have to get this license within 2 years of their certification?
Through the chair, that would be something I would have to get confirmation from deed from. I don't believe they would have to, but if I may, through the chair, if you are on an active certification, you cannot let your license lapse. If you do let your license lapse, there's additional coursework that you have to take, which is pretty significant.
Yeah, just by way of explanation, I guess. I can imagine the situation where a teacher is planning to retire, and they retire, or they got their last 2 years are certificated, but their certificate would lapse 3 months later, and they come back a year later wanting this retired teacher lifetime certificate. Would they be able to get the certificate?
Through the chair, I believe so. However, I do need to confirm that with deed.
Okay. Very good. Thank you.
I think we'll go to invited testimony then. We can. So we have Rebecca Zavarel. Please put your name on the record and begin your testimony. Thank you.
Hi, yes. Becky Zavarel, Zaverl, from Fairbanks, Alaska. Thank you for inviting me. Good afternoon, and thank you for letting me speak on House Bill 147. My name is Becky Zavarl, and I'm the principal at Denali Elementary in Fairbanks, Alaska. I'm a very lucky principal. I first started teaching here at Denali in 2001, and I learned to perfect my craft from the amazing teachers around me. I was a brand new teacher who learned more from my colleagues than I did in my college classes. How does a teacher know how to get a classroom control of 25 five-year-olds? How does a teacher know the best way to teach multiplication? What are the best games and tricks for teaching reading? We learned from each other, and I learned from some of the best, and even became one of the BP Teachers of the Year because of it. 3 years ago, I was honored to become the principal of this school that shaped me, and I have to tell you, though, as a principal, I'm a bit anxious every morning and often Sunday nights, not because of the kids or the staff or the school challenges that we face, but I dread checking that frontline system, which tells me who called out sick. Just today, in fact, I had 10 staff out and only 2 subs. In fact, we started the year off without a music teacher and a special education teacher. Nobody had applied, so when we started, we needed a substitute. But do you know who I called to fill the spot for our music teacher? It was my friend Katie Brown, who retired 2 years ago. She taught at Denali for 30 years, and she came home to help us whenever we need it. Not only Katie, but I have Janet, Crystal, Max, and more. My sub pool is mainly our retired teachers. And they know us, they know the kids, they know the culture of our school, so they come back to help us. When our retired teachers come back, they teach our new teachers. They lend the tricks of the trade. They show off their classroom management skills for all of us to learn from. They have 25 years of experience for us to learn from. They're not done teaching just because they've entered retirement. They've earned the privilege to choose now how to spend their time, and I'm extremely grateful that they choose to come back and help our kids. Our kids benefit from them, too. Can you think of that teacher who made a difference in your life or that teacher who was your favorite? And what if they kept coming back in your life to support you, to cheer you on, to offer guidance? My school is a Title I school, and my kids need all the adults they can in their corner. What this bill will do is offer a little bit of appreciation and respect to those educators who have given us the majority of their life. By covering the cost of their teaching certificate for life, you're saying we thank you, we need you, and we appreciate you. And this bill also addresses our long-term sub problem. By allowing our subs to stay in a position as long as we need them, it gives us, as an administrator, a chance to breathe. I really do love my job. I love our teachers. I love seeing our kids grow and learn, and I like the challenges that education today offers. But it is hard to find people to cover the classrooms. So helping us take this obstacle out of getting people who are tried and true, our beloved retirees, back in the classroom to help us would be greatly appreciated. And to address just some of those questions that came earlier in testimony, I think the why, after they retire, why they came back, is really because they have a love for education. They are attached to the schools that they've been at for years, and they still have that desire to do so, just not every single day sometimes. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we have Sean Prince. Please put your name on the record and begin your testimony.
Yes, good afternoon. My name is Sean Prince, and I am the president of the Anchorage Principals Association. And I wanted to say thank you to all the honorable members of the Labor and Commerce Committee for allowing this testimony today. I would like to offer my perspective for House Bill 147 in support of dealing with the substitute crisis shortage that we have in the state of Alaska. From my perspective as the president of the Anchorage Principals Association, our schools are in a dire need for quality substitute teachers. Speaking with other principals from around the state and hearing the testimony that was just in front of my own, I know that Anchorage is not alone in this need. We are all invested in the future of Alaska, and we all know that retaining Alaskan residents begins with a quality education and job viability now and in the future. Currently, our schools have a substitute shortage, and our teachers all need the support that they can get. Now, speaking from a high school perspective, when teachers need a substitute to cover their classes, and this can happen for a myriad of reasons, and it's beyond illness. It's actually for enrichment opportunities in our schools where our teachers take students to museums, college campus visits, job fairs, internship opportunities, science and CTE field trips to places like the Sea Life Center in Seward, Educator Rising competitions that's actually down in Juneau this year. Field trips to the VA to talk to veterans, view medical campuses for medical academies, and visit cadaver labs here in Anchorage at Providence Hospital, and to go on sporting events because a lot of our teachers are also coaches. And that's when those are planned stand-in substitute situations that require a substitute with a lot of lead time. The unplanned situation is the daily things that we as humans often encounter. Deaths in the family, sick children, car trouble, bursted pipes, snow removal, personal illness, and the unforeseen emergencies that keep many of us away from actually being on the job. It's easier for me as a principal when I think about the substitutes that have already dedicated their lives to education and have strong skills in delivering curriculum, classroom management, and they are the ones that we can call on to be our available substitutes. For our current substitutes, they actually do a fair job, but they are not professional educators. I'm sure that you would agree that having a skilled professional educator standing in actually has no equal. I believe that the House Bill 147 can support this need by stripping away the cost for retired teachers to obtain the lifetime certificate, by extending from 120 days to 165, which does, as pointed out, puts us almost to an entire year. But when you're scrambling at the last minute at the beginning of a school year to find someone to fill a job position, it is difficult, and we need that flexibility as principals. It also encourages our retired or soon-to-be-retired Alaskan teachers to remain in the state and continue to support education in the last frontier. Now, when I think about some of the questions that have come up from the steering committee, I can offer this testimony. I had a teacher who taught in the special education portion of our school, and they taught math. And if you've been in education for a while, you know that a special education math teacher that does a really good job is like a unicorn, and you want to hold on to them as much as we could. Asteria McGrew worked at Bartlett High School for 28 years, and when she retired, I was in a pinch. I could not find a special education teacher to fill this math position, and I called her up. 28 years, she was ready to be retired and be done. But she came back and she worked for me for 3 more years, not because I had a long-standing relationship with her, not because parents were twisting her arm, but because she cared so much about the students that were at our school and the connection she'd made over those years that she agreed to stay on for 3 more years past retirement. It does happen, and it happens actually more than you might think. So I thank you for your time and education, your attention, really, because we know that the majority of the heavy lifting in our schools happens with our teachers, and it needs to start with this. Thank you so much.
Thank you. And it does look like we are joined online by Kelly Manning with Department of with DEED. Did any committee members wish to restate their questions directed to DEED? Representative Prox.
Yes, thank you, Chair Sumner. Through the chair, does this bill just cover teachers who hold a current certificate, retired, and want to maintain their certificate, or if someone has retired for a few years, their certificate has lapsed, can they get this license?
Good afternoon. For the record, this is Kelly Manning, the Deputy Director for the Division of Innovation and Education Excellence. Through the chair, Representative Prox, I think I understand your question to be how would this certification apply? And so the retired certification is one that an educator, once they have retired from the district, can apply for the lifetime retired certification, and they do not have to have a current certification to be eligible for that. So it would be any retired teacher would be eligible for that certification.
Follow it.
Go ahead.
Just to confirm. So any person who has held an Alaska teaching certificate can and then is in retirement status can apply for this lifetime certificate. Is that a fair statement?
Yes, again, for the record, this is Kelly Manning, Department of Ed. Yes, that is correct, Representative Prox.
Great. Okay, thank you.
Okay, any other questions for Deed? No? Any other questions for the bill sponsor? No? Okay. So, Representative Savin?
Thank you. I do have a question through the chair to the sponsor. Just curious, would this bill facilitate teachers, retired teachers, returning not necessarily as in-classroom teachers, but possibly as mentors or master teachers helping other teachers learn those tricks of the trade, how to control five-year-olds, et cetera, et cetera? Would this necessitate them being back in class, or could they serve other functions as a certificated school district employee?
Sure, go ahead. Through the chair, that's not really the purpose of this, but I will say that generally speaking, when you have a retired teacher on staff doing that type of work, it just kind of naturally evolves that way. And then not only that, but they oftentimes take after-school programs or additional duties that maybe they can't find a position for. If there's a, let's say there's a maybe a coaching position, or perhaps a book club position, you know, an after-school activity, oftentimes they will pick those up. But they certainly are doing mentoring and supporting early career educators, and in addition to doing anything else that seems to need, where there seems to be a need in a school.
Through the chair to ma'am, they would not be a person, would they have to be teaching in the classroom, or could they actually be hired as a long-term substitute to be a master teacher, again, not being in the classroom, but still mentoring others? You're saying that as a teacher, they kind of help their colleagues. Could they be in a position they would only be helping their colleagues and not in a classroom?
I'll try to thank you through the chair, Representative Sadler. This bill, the retired teacher on this lifetime certificate would have to apply to be a sub in the district and follow those rules to have that job in the schools.
Through the chair, I'm not really sure if I heard an answer. I'm just trying to clarify, if someone gets, if a teacher is retired, gets a retired certificate, must they be a classroom teacher, or could they serve another function in the district?
So through the chair, I believe that this only deals with substitutes. So if you're talking about being a mentor, that's a different position. And so I believe the answer would be no.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Seeing no other questions, we're going to set this bill aside for future hearing. Thank you, Representative. Moving on to House Bill 186, a bill from House Labor and Commerce Committee. Today, we invited industry experts to weigh in on the bill. We're going to start with Alicia Maltby of ABC Alaska. Please put your name on the record and begin.
Chair Sumner and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Alicia Maltby. I am the president and CEO of Associated Builders and Contractors of Alaska. ABC was founded in 1950 to create an association based on the shared belief that construction projects should be awarded on merit to the most qualified and responsible low bidders, and performing our work with the utmost responsibility, skill, and integrity. Nationally, we are now 23,000 members strong, and the Alaska chapter represents over 130 merit shop contractors and suppliers. We also operate the largest construction apprenticeship program in the state, which champions the ideals of free enterprise, develop training for the workforce, and provide contractors with resources to compete in the ever-changing world of construction. Today, I would like to talk about House Bill 186 and the challenges and potential unintended consequences we as an organization believe it poses for the state's contracting community. ABC strongly supports enforcement of Alaska's labor laws, but while we may have a common goal to ensure compliance, the solution contained in House Bill 186 seems to be the wrong approach, and arguably a solution looking for a problem. Not only would House Bill 186 take away 30 years of progress in the contracting community for those that are doing it correctly, but it would also set a dangerous precedent for enforcement of Alaska's laws and regulations. Recent data provided by the Department of Labor does not indicate a significant issue that justifies such a radical approach to change the current enforcement model. And while some of the letters of support claim to see violations, the Department of Labor data doesn't seem to indicate they are filing complaints. Maybe the first step is to encourage those believing they are witnessing violations to report them to the Department of Labor and see how the department would handle them. So this begs the question, why is the legislation being proposed based on historical anecdotal hearsay rather than solid data and facts? Are we confident that there's a problem, or are we taking our industry backwards in time to when contracting was seen as a dirty business? My members take great offense to such a broad assertion that they are cheating the system and being accused of egregious claims such as being involved in human trafficking. While the bill prohibits investigators from having a conflict of interest, there is no definition of what that conflict would be. For instance, we would assert that an employee of any construction contractor being paid by a construction company would have a conflict of interest in investigating other contractors, going on their job sites, and reviewing their proprietary business information. Additionally, ABC believes union employees would have an inherent conflict of interest in investigating non-union construction companies. We believe that these employees investigating the proprietary books of non-union companies is a conflict of interest and should be specifically spelled out in this bill. We would also agree that non-union contractors would have a conflict of interest in using their employee to voluntarily investigate a union company and have full access to confidential payroll and employment records. Although we have full confidence in the Dunleavy administration writing regulations without statutory definitions, the current language of this bill could easily allow the next administration to adopt any language they so choose. Additionally, if a conflict of interest should occur, there is an insufficient definition of how that will be managed. Simply removing this person from a job site is not an adequate consequence and would not hold anyone accountable for their actions. At minimum, investigating a private business with a conflict of interest should be a crime, should be well-defined, and the employer being investigated should have a say in whether a conflict of interest exists prior to disclosing any information to the volunteer labor compliance officer. The types of confidential human resource information being outlined in this bill are required to standard lock and key by contractors. It's unfathomable that a volunteer with minimal training or experience related to payroll would be allowed access to such sensitive, nuanced information. Now that brings me to liabilities. Under House Bill 186, under Section 23.05.420, it's requiring workers' compensation for a volunteer under the employer's worker comp policy. This is an important relationship. The volunteer investigator is required to have workers' compensation under their employer's workers' compensation policy. This provision seems to indicate that someone could be an actual volunteer and would have to have an employer paying them for their time investigating and covering their workers' compensation coverage. A coverage under a workers' compensation policy, the volunteer investigator must be performing work for the employer within the scope of work that the employer is providing, an employer-employee relationship. This means the employer would have supervisory control over the employee while they are investigating, theoretically on behalf of the State Department. This raises a multitude of challenges. Number one, will a disclosure be required for the employee, the employer of the volunteer compliance officers? If so, will the employer's conflicts of interest be disclosed? Number two, if the employer will have a supervisory role over the investigator, shouldn't the employer also be required to complete the training through the Department of Labor? And number three, is the employer liable for the actions of their employee while acting as a volunteer investigator? Enforcement of the State of Alaska laws and regulations is and should remain the sole responsibility of the state. And the full power and the authority of the State of Alaska is behind volunteer individuals performing said enforcement. Those individuals should be held to the same standards and face the same consequences of improprieties like any other State of Alaska employee. ABC appreciates the interest and enforcement of Alaska's labor laws and regulations, and we support the protection of Alaska businesses and our workers. But we need to identify the problem before proposing such a drastic approach to a solution at a statewide level. Thank you so much. I appreciate the opportunity for you allowing me to speak today.
Thank you. Next, we're going to hear from the Department of Labor. We have Tanya Keith. Please put your name on the record and begin your testimony.
Hi, this is Tanya Keith, the Director of Labor Standards and Safety. Thank you. I am not actually here to testify. I was told that I was here to answer any questions that anyone had about the bill.
Okay. Looks like we have questions. Representative Fields.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think more a question for Ms. Keith through the chair for background to consider this bill. Ms. Keith, there have been declining rates of staffing in departments of labor around the country. Some departments have gone to a strategic enforcement approach. Other departments have stayed with the more old school kind of first in, first out approach. How would you characterize the Department of Labor Standards and Safety approach currently? Do you use first in, first out? Do you also use strategic enforcement? Is there other information that would be relevant? Thank you.
Thank you, through the chair, Representative Fields. Yes, we do use a strategic approach. We have 10 to 12 investigators at any one time covering the state, and those investigators cover 21,000 businesses in Alaska, as well as 2,400 public projects that have been started just since 2021. So it is a wide range of businesses and industries that we're overseeing. So we use a strategic approach where when we get a lot of calls with an industry, we focus or about a certain business, we'll focus our enforcement on those.
Can I ask a follow-up? Thank you. Through the chair, Ms. Keith, maybe you could provide some historical perspective. How does the department look at kind of staffing per man hour, staffing per X number of dollars invested in the industry over time to get a sense of adequacy of staffing? And secondarily, my impression is that industries where you have a higher union density, like construction, I'm guessing you have higher rates of reports of issues just because you have business agents out on the job. Is it true that those sectors with higher rates of union density have more complaints compared to, say, a sector with almost zero union density where there just aren't people out there talking to workers? Is that an accurate assumption? Thank you.
Thank you. Through the chair, Representative Fields. So when we do our investigations, they're prioritized mainly through complaints that we receive. Our authority to collect wages is tied, and our enforcement is tied directly to an assignment received from an employee. I think that as far as complaints that we receive, we find historically that union representation isn't necessarily correlate into more complaints. I think sometimes job sites that have unions that are actually advocating for the employees, sometimes they take care of those issues before they come to our office. We receive a lot of complaints from low-wage workers, such as fast food or CNAs in assisted living facilities, where they have no other avenue of recourse to solve their issues than to come to the department. I hope that answers your question.
Thank you.
Representative Prox.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Through the chair, does the state have people that monitor this sort of stuff in the regular course of their duties for a state contract on a, I guess it'd be probably either a building or a road or whatever, that I would think that adherence to wage and labor laws would be part of the contract, and that the state has somebody that manages the contract and would catch these things. Do you know whether that's the case?
Through the chair. Thank you, Representative Prox. Yes, most agencies that have contracts do have, like DOT, for example, has project managers who are on site and oversee those projects. And in fact, we get a lot of our information about what's going on in the field, especially in rural Alaska, from those individuals who are monitoring those for compliance, because by law they are required to be sure that the contractors are following the prevailing wage law.
And I guess the same question would probably apply to grant agencies. Some, I think you mentioned assisted care facilities. If they're operating under a grant or a contract with the state, would the state audit those companies for compliance to wage and hour and job safety?
Through the chair, Representative Crox, wage and hour only audits on a regular basis public construction Title 36. I do know that in some of those other industries, like the assisted living, they are subject to licensing requirements, and we get a lot of our reports of violations in those industries do come from the other state agencies that monitor those industries.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Heath, my question to you is, where else does the Department of Labor and Workforce Development look to volunteers to enforce labor standards and safety to look at your bailiwick? I'm assuming that there are laws and regulations allowing for folks to report when they see an unsafe or illegal labor practice on the site, but just help me understand what the current role of volunteers is in ensuring compliance with state labor laws.
Through the chair, thank you, Representative Sadler. We do not have any volunteers in the Department of Labor enforcing labor laws. We do take any tips or calls through our office from anybody who is on a job site who sees an issue and take those reports and take appropriate action.
If you could, through the chair, help me characterize, understand if that happens often, and even if not often, what is the nature of those reports? Is that actually about work, about payroll issues, or is it more work safety, work site safety issues? Just help me understand more what they might give tips on, and how many.
Through the chair, thank you. We get calls every day. We have investigators on duty who take those calls, and usually if they're having a issue with their employer, it's not usually limited to just their pay. We will, if it's a other issue with another department, we will refer them to the other department or make the referral ourselves. We get complaints of not receiving your final paycheck, unsafe work practices, harassment, not getting your taxes paid, a multitude of issues that kind of end up in our office. And as I said, we'll take care of the part that falls within our jurisdiction and then make sure that person gets pointed to the appropriate agency to take care of the other issues they're facing.
Okay. Thank you. Another question, if I could, through the chair to Ms. Heath. I don't know if you can actually respond to this, but we've heard some of the other testifiers say that they did not see a need for this. I think I heard the term solution in search of a problem. But I guess if you would venture an opinion, do you think that the program envisioned this bill would be beneficial to helping improve compliance with state labor and labor practice laws?
Through the chair, I don't really have an opinion.
Fair enough. Thank you.
Mrs. Keith, I actually have a question. So at present, if there was a report from a third party, non-employee of violations of Alaska labor law, how would your department process that, whether it be public or a private project?
Thank you, Chair Sumner. Chair Sumner, we would take the information. And based on the information that was being provided, how egregious the violation was, if it was employees not getting paid at all, not getting paid minimum wage, or something more minor, or possibly a lot of times we get calls where they think maybe somebody's not providing appropriate compliance with wage and hour laws. We have a myriad of steps we can take. We'll call the employer sometimes to have a conversation with them. We will sometimes send a letter letting them know that we received this issue and informing them what the laws are. Sometimes we will make site visits
And those site visits sometimes can result in our office opening an investigation. So there's a number of steps we can take depending upon the information that's reported from the caller.
And Mrs. Keith, do you think it is now or has been, whether informal or formal, department policy to only respond to employee complaints?
Yes, Chair Sumner. It has not been a policy to only respond to employee complaints. We do take third-party information and take appropriate action based on the information that we receive from that person. One thing we cannot do is open an investigation based on a third party because our enforcement is through investigating complaints. And in order to take court action, we need to have an assignment from the employee to be able to go after their wages.
Thank you. Representative Fields?
Thank you. through the chair, I think there's widespread documentation of wage theft being epidemic throughout the country. And I guess I wanted to ask through the chair, Ms. Keith, to maybe reflect on her and her colleagues' expertise as they've worked on these cases over the years. I know that groups like Alaska Institute for Justice, I think Alaska Legal Services Corporation, have referred cases to Wage and Hour when they've run into people who are whose rights are not being honored. And I'm actually kind of curious to tap the institutional expertise of Ms. Keith and her colleagues about, you know, based on your experience, what groups of employees maybe are less aware of their labor rights? Are there ways to tap community groups' expertise to make sure that those labor rights are reflected, I think, consistent with the intent of the bill. But I certainly don't feel like I've got a great idea if we wanted to protect people's rights, what would the full, really, menu of options be? And I know that our department employees have a lot of experience and would appreciate their reflection on it, not necessarily right now, but as we continue consideration of this bill. Thank you.
Representative Prox?
Yes, thank you. Through the chair. Oops, I'm sorry. We didn't hear from her.
Oh, sorry.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, through the chair to Representative Fields. Alaska law doesn't actually have a definition of wage theft, but we do see a number of issues coming into our office, and it could be a lot of our calls are about an employee not receiving a final paycheck that's due within 3 days if they are terminated, and by the next pay period if they quit, and a lot of times just a phone call to the employer saying that their paycheck is past due will facilitate them getting that paycheck. To a multitude of reasons, an employer who isn't aware of the overtime laws, an employer who didn't pay based on the wage rate that they had promised the employee. There's just a number of issues that we seem to find. We do find that we get a lot of complaints from immigrants who maybe, or really lower paid people in low paid industries, and they're just not aware of their rights. We have worked with some government agencies, and I'll use assisted living as an example. They're licensing to allow them to distribute pamphlets to employees who are working in those facilities so that they are aware of their rights when we saw the uptick of complaints in that industry.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Prox.
Thank you. Through the chair, I would think that an employer who is a member of, well, we'll use the construction industry as a case in point. There's, and I can't remember the association now, but anyway, there's two. One of roughly the union shops and the other of the merit shops. But I would think either one of them would be pretty fastidious about complying with really the conditions of the contract either way, but especially in a union situation, I would think that this would be a matter between the union and the employer, is a contractual problem. And it sounded like from previous testimony that the state was getting involved with what is this, if it's a state job, the state should get involved. But the state was getting involved in what seemed to me to be a contractual relationship between the employer and, in this case, the union employees. Does the state get involved, or should the state be involved in contractual violations as opposed to state labor law?
Through the chair, Representative Prox, we do not get involved in labor issues or contracts. When we go out to investigate a job site, if it is a public construction site, we are specifically and only looking to see that all of the employees and contractors working on that site are getting paid the prevailing wage for the classification of work they are doing. When we are on a private site, we are looking to enforce the wage and hour law, which requires that employees are paid at least minimum wage and receive overtime for all of the hours that they are working.
Okay, I guess that makes sense. Thank you.
Thank you, Mrs. Keith. And do you know, how does the state enforce Alaska labor laws on out-of-state contractors with out-of-state employees?
Yes, Representative Chair Sumner. So the same way we do with Alaskan employers, we receive, when we get a notice of award, the agency and the prime contractor notify us of the contractors that are on site. We ensure that we get a notice of work from those contractors, and we ensure that they have proper business licensing and contractor's licensing, and provide them with any education that we think that they might need through their work.
So it is not, I just want to be clear, it's not the position of the Department of Labor that for any period of time Alaska labor laws do not apply to out-of-state contractors with out-of-state employees working in the state of Alaska?
Chair Sumner, no. All employees who are working in the state of Alaska are subject to Alaska labor laws, and the location of the employer makes no difference. We routinely do investigations for companies that are out of state.
Thank you. Representative Sadler?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair to Ms. Heath, you know, it appears to me the essential question we face is whether there's a need that justifies the program that's envisioned by this bill. And while, of course, it's impossible for us to, for you to know exactly how many violations there are that your division misses, it's like you don't know what you don't know. But as you're in the business and know most more about it than we do, well, most of us anyway, is there, in your opinion, is there a clear crisis or a need to essentially deputize labor compliance officers from outside of your ranks? Help us know what the scope of the issue we face or the problem we face is.
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, I can only say that we are not receiving a significant number of complaints on public projects at all. I will tell you that the staff in Wage and Hour does a great job of auditing a large percentage of the certified payroll that we receive and catching issues and correcting those before we even receive a complaint.
Approved. And Ms. Heath, through the chair, you said you're not getting many complaints on public projects. Not sure if you're making a clear differentiation between public and private. Should I ask you specifically what the need is on private construction projects?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, we are not receiving a significant number of complaints for private construction projects either. In 2023, we received one public construction complaint and 11 private complaints from construction companies, although we can't differentiate if those were all actually tradesman working or if it could have been a secretary for the construction company.
Thank you, Ms. Heath. Thank you, Ms. Scherr.
Okay. We're going to take a brief, a 5-minute at ease, and then we'll return with Bronson Fry. Unless anybody has any more questions for Tanya Keith, we will move on. Next, we have Bronson Fry of Local 1959. Please put your name on the record and begin your testimony.
Hello there. My name is Bronson Fry. I am the president of the Building and Construction Trade Council of South Central Alaska, the business representative of the International Union of Painters and Allied Trades, Alaska Local 1959. Thank you very much for the opportunity to testify today. I am testifying in support of House Bill 186, and I spent a lot of time thinking about how I wanted to approach this issue. I think that we can all agree that victims of human trafficking is bad, wage theft is bad, employee misclassification is bad, but I want to approach this from a little bit different angle, and that is from the perspective of honest construction employers and contractors. But to do that, we need to have kind of a shared understanding of the bidding process that is germane to construction. So when a contractor sits down to bid a job, they're essentially adding up the cost of four main categories. You have your materials, you have your overhead, you have your profit, and you have your labor. Now, your material cost is about the same for everybody, your price for lumber, your price for a bucket of paint, etc. Your overhead, that's about the same for everybody, taking the time to look at the blueprints and run your office, depending on how big the office is you're in, about the same for everyone. Your profit, the percent of the other three factors added together, is about the same for each industry, pipe fitting, glazing, carpentry, etc. So the only real variable is that fourth factor, your labor cost. And so we have in construction a situation where whoever can reduce, whether through honest or dishonest means, their labor cost is oftentimes rewarded by getting the job. Now, as Representative Fields correctly pointed out earlier, wage theft is real. It's real across this country, and it's real in Alaska, and there is mountains of evidence to prove that. And unfortunately, the easiest employee to victimize through wage theft are often those who are already victims of human trafficking. But let me give you another example of how an unscrupulous employer can game the system to gain an unfair advantage in this bidding process. When an employer requires as a condition of employment that each of their employees goes out and gets a business license and self-performs as a so-called independent contractor or owner-operator, they're no longer required to provide workers' compensation. Now, construction is inherently dangerous, and depending on your trade, your average workers' compensation rate in the industry is about 30% of your labor cost. So when you start taking these factors together, whether it's employee misclassification as independent contractors, outright wage threat theft through not paying overtime or not paying the correct prevailing wage, or victimizing those already victimized by through human trafficking, you can see that you can incentivize dishonest contractors to adopt these unscrupulous business models, and they end up being rewarded for that. So one of the things that I have to say is that I've been listening to the testimony here, and I am absolutely mystified why it is that the Associated Builders and Contractors are not fully in support of this. Because I heard the lady say that their mission statement is to help qualified and responsible low bidders with an emphasis on honesty and fairness. Well, the reality is the responsible, honest contractors are the ones getting cheated out of the opportunities to do these jobs. It seems to me that a contractor group would be happy to support something that prevented these dishonest employers from gaming the system to their advantage. Now, let's put ourselves now in the shoes of the workers. Imagine you are, in fact, a victim of human trafficking, And this sort of wage theft, this employee misclassification as independent contractors, you're completely disincentivized from self-reporting to the Department of Labor for very understandable and real fear of retaliation. And that means, conversely, that these unscrupulous employers are incentivized to engage in these practices. The ABC provided testimony earlier that said that the Department of Labor says there's not a significant number of cases of this being a problem. Then the representative from the Department of Labor turned around and said that they have 10 to 12 investigators covering 21,000 businesses. And in 2021, 24,000 projects. So we can understand and acknowledge that the greatest victims of employee misclassification, wage theft, human trafficking, and construction are completely disincentivized from self-reporting, that honest contractors are being cheated, dishonest contractors are incentivized to adopt these unscrupulous business models, and it is absolutely reasonable for us as a state to take a position that there would be great utility in a voluntary compliance officer program such as that proposed in House Bill 186. The last thing I'll say is that we've got between $4 and $6 billion of construction work coming to Alaska over the next decade. And this should not be a place that rewards cheating, dishonest, unscrupulous contractors that victimize their employees. So please pass House Bill 186 out of your committee. Thank you.
Do any committee members have Representative Prox?
Yes, thank you. Through the chair, you know, what we've got now is hearsay testimony is all we're going on. And I wouldn't be surprised if this does occur at some point, but the scope, there's residential contractors, there's contractors that work on fairly large projects, and then there's contractors that work on very big projects. Is this occurring? Which segment in your estimation, we'll take the hearsay, which segment in your estimation is this most prevalent in the small scale, the medium scale, or the large scale projects?
I would say without question, all of them. I have personally been doing commercial construction in Alaska and Anchorage my entire adult life. Started my apprenticeship in the Painters Union when I was 19 years old. Became a union organizer in June 2007. So however many years that is. I have been on large prevailing wage projects as recently as just a few weeks ago up in Fairbanks, talking to workers that fall into this category. I've been on residential jobs and projects all over the state. Same problem. I don't believe that there is a great difference in where the problem exists. If an employer thinks that they can game the system, again, due in large part to the bidding process germane to construction, they will do so, whether their personal niche is residential, light commercial, or larger projects.
Follow up? You use the term prevailing wage, so I'm assuming that the condition of the contract is that they're going to pay the individual crafts whatever the prevailing wage might be. And are you speaking of projects that are under a written contract to pay a prevailing wage, and then it turns out they're not paying the prevailing wage?
Well, I'm really glad you asked that. Because let me bring us back to that example I gave you about an employer who requires as a condition of employment that their employees go out and get a business license and self-perform as a so-called independent subcontractor. Well, that employer now no longer has employees to list on prevailing wage.
Mm-hmm.
So it absolutely does happen on these larger jobs. It's quite frustrating, as you might expect, for honest employers who are looking at this and saying, well, wait a minute. I'm looking at this job. There's 5 drywall finishers or 10 painters on this thing. And yet when you look at certified payroll, oh, there's just one guy, the owner of the company that bid the project.
Right.
And so while we have good intentions with the laws that we set up in our state, it doesn't mean that they can't be skirted. It doesn't mean that dishonest, unscrupulous employers can't game the system. And that's exactly what I'm telling you. They do. They are. It's sad. We have a lot of work coming to our state, and we've got to have checks and balances that prevent these type of dishonest employers from being rewarded for their unscrupulous business models they adopt.
Right. Paula, I get that. Is this something you have personally witnessed? Or
absolutely.
Well, and then
many times over and over, all over the state.
Right. Paula, this would be a union job then. You say you work for the union, correct?
If you're asking me if the jobs that I'm referring to are union jobs, no, I would say that is not the case. If you're asking me if I work for a union, if that's my job, yes. But if you're asking about the projects that I'm referring to where this takes place, no, these are openly bid jobs. Union and non-union contractors are on them. They're large-scale prevailing wage all the way down to small housing projects.
Follow up? What I'm trying to understand is how you would be personally involved if you're working on a union contract. If you're working on a union contract, it would seem to me to be the job of the union to represent their members. And why are unions not doing that?
Well, sir, I, as I mentioned, I started as a union organizer in 2007, and I still self-identify as a union organizer in my heart, no matter what title I carry at any given time. And as such, it's my job to talk to workers and try to help them better their lives in however ways I can. And so throughout the years of talking to workers on job sites and asking them these questions, I can testify with authority and with certainty on what I'm saying here.
Interesting. All right, I'll leave it at that.
Representative Carrick.
Thank you. Through the chair. So, Mr. Fry, the bill as currently written would allow someone who's currently employed in the construction industry to act as a voluntary labor compliance officer. And I'm just wondering what your perspective would be on the potential for competitors on projects to act in that capacity on a competitor's project. And is that something we should be concerned about at all?
Thank you. Through the chair, in my experience, owners of construction companies are extremely, extremely mindful of every penny they spend. I have not ever met a company that would invest their resources in going around and trying to abuse something such as proposed in House Bill 186. I don't think that that's a real concern. I think it's a rather hyperbolic claim that that would be something that would actually take place in the real world. So the answer is no. I do not think that would be an issue.
Follow up. So through the chair, just, you know, in consideration of that, the bill also requires a certain amount of construction experience in order to act as a volunteer labor compliance officer. So do you foresee that there would be a pool of individuals not currently employed in the construction industry, but who would be able to meet the qualifications to act in that capacity?
Well, sure. I think there's a lot of industry groups that have a vested interest in seeing that honest employers are rewarded for being honest. I think the ABC falls into that category. That's why I'm a little mystified they're not supporting this. The answer to your question is yes. I believe that we could reasonably expect that there would be people that would volunteer to step up in this capacity were House Bill 186 passed into law.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Fry. We're going to move along and Okay. Representative Prox, and then Representative
I hate to belabor the point, but through the chair, Mr. Fry, I understood you to say that you're always a union contractor, and I'm wondering, you must be getting this information then from, if you will, non-union job sites. So my question is, how do you get on the job site in the first place?
To be clear, I am not a union contractor. I am a union organizer. So the point of clarity there. And it's easy to talk to construction workers. You don't necessarily have to find them on a job site. You can find construction workers all over. Sometimes they're on job sites. Sometimes they're at a restaurant. Sometimes they're at the paint store. This is something I take seriously, something I've applied my entire, almost my whole career to. And if you put your mind to it, you can find construction workers and strike up a conversation and get a lot of that information in that capacity.
Okay, very good. Thank you.
Yes, sir.
Okay, Representative Sadler.
Thank you. Quickly through the chair, Mr. Fry, you have intimated at least that wage theft and human trafficking and other challenges are large and growing problems in Alaska, but we've got information before us from the Department of Labor showing that the total wage claims has decreased dramatically since 2018 from 250 down to 50. Help me reconcile what seems to be a conflict.
Yeah, great question. To the chair, I would point out that the Department of Labor, again, testified 10 to 12 investigators covering 21,000 businesses. 2021 had 24,000 projects. So there's a lot of ground that may not be, covered in the way that it could be. The other thing is, I'm going to reemphasize this, most of the victims that we're talking about, victims of wage theft, victims of human trafficking and construction, victims of employee misclassification as independent contractors, are themselves disincentivized from self-reporting for fear of retaliation. So that is sort of something that I believe we can't actually talk about this without having an understanding and walking a mile in those people's shoes and looking at it from their perspective.
Last year. Through the chair, Mr. Fry, I have heard you mention several times the issue about employees being reclassified as independent contractors. Do you believe that the volunteer compliance officers, as envisioned by this bill, would be able to address that issue?
Yes, sir, I would. The easiest way to do that would be to simply ask if an individual worker is covered by a workers' compensation policy, because most of the time they're not. Once that employer classifies them as an independent contractor, they're no longer responsible for workers' compensation premiums. And the worker, if they want a policy, they're going to have to pay for it out of their own pocket. That's a major problem. We got people should not be waking up in the morning worried that they'll go to work and suffer an injury that's going to bankrupt their family. That's baloney, and we should do better than that in our state.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Fry. Last to testify is Matt Capici, sorry if I mispronounced that, representative of the General President, United Brotherhood of Carpenters and Joiners of America. Please put your name on the record and begin your testimony. Thank you.
Yes, Chair Sumner. My name is Matthew Capice. I'm a representative of the General President with the United Brotherhood of Carpenters and Joiners of America. My job for the United Brotherhood of Carpenters and Joiners of America is across the United States to track cases of failures of contractors in the construction industry to comply with labor and employment tax laws. I also do investigation work with our Carpenter Regional Council affiliates. I track legislation, state and federal legislation on the problem, and I do a lot of public speaking to industry groups about this issue. Now, I supplied some written comments on the legislation. I won't belabor the points there. You have it there to read, and if anyone has any questions about what I wrote after I'm done talking, if the chair permits, I can be asked questions. But there's one thing I want to bring up. In my written remarks, I cited a study that was done by economists for an organization called the Century Foundation on fraud in the construction industry, and they identified in Alaska $4.7 million in wage theft. That's not a small number. But I want to clarify something that I should have in my written remarks. That $4.7 million is just unpaid overtime. It doesn't include, for instance, unpaid minimum wages or people not being construction workers not being paid at all. Brother Fry has given a lot of information locally about what's happening in Alaska. I won't pretend to know as much as him about what's happening in the industry, but I can tell you what we see happening in the low 48 with this problem of wage theft and illegal employment practices in the construction industry. When I first started with the United Brotherhood of Carpenters, I was assigned to do investigation work with our regional council in Florida. And there I was introduced to the labor broker fraud model. A labor broker isn't able-bodied labor or manpower. It's a guy or a woman who knows workers and who knows contractors. And the contractors reach out to those labor brokers to supply labor. And the labor brokers frequently or almost always will pay people off the books or misclassify them as subcontractors. Most of the time they're paid cash that is collected from check cashing stores. In one investigation that was being conducted in Florida by their fraud investigators and their insurance division, their workers' comp insurance division, they found one of these check cashing stores had been opened up illegally or allegedly illegally by a member of a New York crime family. So this stuff can get pretty dark. Like I said, I work across the United States, and I would tell my colleagues in the northern part of the United States about what we were seeing in the South and in Florida back in 2003. And I was met with some skepticism and some guffaws that this sort of thing wouldn't happen there, that they don't see the labor broker problem. Well, I can tell you, they are really seeing it now. It is everywhere. We're seeing contractors on hospital projects, military bases, universities, even state legislative office buildings, semiconductor plants, convention centers, luxury condominium towers, and even at IRS and CDC construction, getting their workers from labor brokers who in some fashion or another are committing wage theft, paying people off the books, and violating employment, state and federal employment tax laws. We're also seeing labor trafficking. And one of those instances is described in my written remarks. But there's another case where a labor broker was sent to jail for engaging in sex trafficking. He was purchasing children to have sex with. And so he is now been sentenced to jail for sex trafficking. There are instances of labor trafficking, not just in Minnesota, but in other places around the country, from Maine to South Dakota. I remember visiting a construction trailer where workers were being warehoused in Kansas, and it was a filthy trailer with eight or more workers that were sleeping on the floor of the trailer. So bad and dark things are happening in our industry. And fair questions are being asked about, well, why aren't we seeing a lot of complaints? Well, let me quote to you something that was said to a reporter by a notorious labor broker in Tennessee called Richard Mike Nobles. When he said about his workers who were immigrants and who were many who were undocumented immigrants, he said, "Mexicans aren't going to sue you for workers' compensation like Americans will. This is what it boils down to. We have these people intimidated." So there is a lot of bad conduct and a lot of intentional conduct. And recently, something happened that was rather shocking and alarming to us. A labor broker approached one of our union affiliates and bragged that they had 6,000 workers that they could put on construction sites, and they wanted to work with our affiliate to refer workers to the construction of a battery, a large multi-billion dollar battery facility. Our business agents there asked this labor broker, "Well, how are these people going to be classified? Are they going to be employees?" And the labor broker said, "No, they would all be independent contractors." Now, of course, we said no and showed him the door, but I'm sure that labor broker didn't stop with us, and they're probably approaching other individuals, other construction companies looking for business to supply their labor. So I would be happy to answer any questions about what I've just said or my written remarks. I've got a lot of experience on this issue, so I'd be happy to answer any of your questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Prox.
Thank you, Chair Sumner. Through the chair, there was a question earlier about conflict of interest, and that's a big concern of mine. I don't think you're going to find the local Rotary Club or some church organization volunteering to take what's probably fairly dangerous work. You're going to find competing companies, be it a legitimate contractor or a labor union or somebody who has a financial interest in suppressing competition. So how are we going to define, or do you have any insight on it to how conflict of interest is defined in other states or somewhere where this might be in practice?
Well, a little bit about suppressing business. Well, right now in the construction industry, the marketplace is favoring employers who cheat. So there's a suppression of business for law-abiding employers, and I think things are turning backwards, where law-abiding employers need protection from cheating competitors, and that's something that we should all be interested in. Now, I can't begin to think of how conflict of interest is defined in Alaska or in other states, but in your bill, the bill provides for folks being trained by your Department of Labor. There is a lot of language there about how people are supposed to act professionally and appropriately, and not personally, or not to benefit anyone else besides enforcing the laws of the state. And also, these volunteers, they're eyes and ears. They're a vanguard, as I said in my written comments. They're not issuing citations. Whatever they see, they're going to tell the Department of Labor about their suspicions, and it's the Department of Labor that's going to go out and finalize the investigation and issue any citations.
Representative Fields.
Thanks to the chair. I guess I just wanted to ask Representative Prox's question in a little different way. There are worker advocacy groups like Towards Justice is a fairly well-known one in the Mountain West here in Alaska, Alaska Institute for Justice. Could you just give some examples of other groups that advocate for workers, particularly immigrants, that are not labor unions? Because I think public knowledge of those is not widespread, but as I read this bill, I think that those are some of the groups that would actually use it. Thank you.
Well, there, in just about every state, you're going to have low-wage worker advocacy groups / protection groups. I can't begin to name them all. I know in Minnesota, there's an organization called SAPOOL, that talks to workers, and if they find that there are injustices and exploitation happening of immigrant workers that they're consulting with, they'll give them some support and help walk them through the process of filing complaints with the state. In fact, this organization, SAPOOL, was central in bringing forward and supporting the workers against Ricardo Batres.
Okay. Well, thank you, Mr. Capiz. And seeing no other questions, we are going to set this bill aside for future hearing. Next on the agenda is House Bill 192, a bill from my office. We need to adopt a new version of House Bill 192. Representative Sadler, do you have a motion?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move the House Labor and Commerce Committee adopt the committee substitute for House Bill 192, version B for Bravo, also referred to as 33-LS0753/B for Bravo.
And I will object for discussion. I'm going to now have my staff, Serena Hackenmiller, please approach the committee, put your name on the record, and begin.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Chair Sumner. For the record, my name is Serena Hackenmiller. I'm staff to Chair Sumner. This is a bill, excuse me for the microphone, one second. This is a bill regarding the curbside pickup and delivery alcohol in Alaska. Since our last hearing, there were two questions. I've delivered the answers to those questions to the representatives who asked, and I can provide those for the remaining committee members after this. And I just want to quickly go through the summary of changes. This committee substitute mostly will add transition language for the Alcohol and Marijuana Control Board to adopt regulations and provides for an effective date. And the change is mostly in Section 9 and Section 10. So this Section 9 is adding transition language, and Section 10 is changing and updating, changing the section number and updating the date of effectiveness.
Okay, questions? Okay, I will remove my objection. Without objection, the committee substitute is adopted. We do have invited testimony. We'll start with Deb Heron from Walmart. Please put your name on the record and begin your testimony.
Good afternoon, Chair Sumner and members of the House Labor and Commerce Committee. This is Deborah Heron, and I am the Director of State and Local Government Affairs for Walmart in Alaska. And I'm happy to join you late today on Friday, and know you've had a full hearing already. So I will make my comments brief, but happy to stand for questions. Walmart is in support of House Bill 192. This is a service that is very much appreciated by our customers to be able to pick up their grocery orders all in one service to their car. Curbside delivery was something that we utilized or that was made available to our customers for 2020 and 2021, and we are supportive of this bill to allow that permissibility to be permanent. We are also supportive of the language in the bill that allows for alcohol beverages to be included in delivery orders. Customer delivery of groceries and orders from our store is very common as well. And our customers have let us know that they would very much like to be able to have a bottle of wine or a six pack of beer included in that order so that they can have it all together. Again, it's a convenience and a service that we can provide those customers. We do so in 38 other states in the country, and we take these matters very seriously. All of our associates that handle any regulated product, and in this case it would be alcohol, are over the age of 21. They all go through very thorough training on a regular basis within our Walmart structure. We've developed our own alcohol training for those associates that are handling the product. We always make sure to check before the product is handed over at curbside that the recipient is the person that placed the order, that they are over 21. And we do take an assessment of sobriety at that point. And we do not hand over any alcohol if the driver is not 21, if there's any issue or question about sobriety. And the same training and same thoroughness has happened at the doorstop as well if this is a customer that would receive their grocery order by delivery. Let me see what other questions you might want to ask. Again, curbside and delivery is available in 38 other states. I apologize. I didn't have a map ready for you for the presentation and PowerPoint information in your hearing this afternoon, but certainly have some materials that we will distribute to you, Chair Sumner, and the committee after the hearing today. At this point, I know you've had a lot of testimony on a lot of issues, so I'll stop here and stand for questions. I'm happy to answer anything that the committee might like to ask me about Walmart's business.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Sadler?
Thank you. Through the chair, Ms. Heron, I'll be quick and understand it's late in the day. Just to help understand scoping this issue, how much of the business at Walmart's in Alaska is curbside pickup? And conversely, and how much is in-store alcohol sales?
Chair Sumner, Representative Sadler, I don't believe I would have those numbers available offhand in terms of being able to accurately answer how much of our business holistically is curbside. We operate 9 stores throughout the state. Each of those stores do offer curbside currently. This is a service that we started I believe in 2016, and now all of the stores in Alaska do offer curbside. However, we have liquor licenses at 4 of them. And so there would be a little bit of apples to oranges to answer your question. But I'm happy to try to work with our operators to come back to you with a little bit more detail on that.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
Representative,
I can tell you that the curbside is extremely popular. Based on our staffing, we can serve a certain number of slots at each store each day, and those slots are generally full. The person who's ordering curbside is typically making a plan ahead, so they're looking at our app. They log in. They select the items that they want to order. They choose a pickup day and time. They're planning ahead. So, you know, very often it's an individual who's going to stop at the store to pick up their order on the way to or from work. They tend not to be last minute purchases. You can plan to pick up your order up to several days, up to a week in advance. There are certain slots during the day. There are dedicated parking spaces at our facilities that are contiguous or adjacent to the buildings. They are well marked. When a customer arrives at that space, they are able to either use the app or call to the dedicated curbside pickup team that's located inside the building. That team of people that are the personal shoppers are, that's their role. It's their job function. It's what they were hired to do for Walmart. It is the same people day in and day out. The same thing with our delivery service. The delivery service is offered on a day-to-day basis, but generally you're not able to receive a delivery order in less than 3 hours. There's a premium price on that. Again, we know our delivery drivers, they interact with our pickup team regularly day in and day out. And I can tell you just anecdotally from our operators that this service is extremely popular at each one of our stores.
Thank you. Representative Prox?
Thank you, Chair Sumner. Before I ask, because I don't know that it's appropriate for me to ask the question, frankly, are we going to hear from someone from the Alcohol Beverage Control Board or Department of Public Safety as far as enforcement, if the state's enforcing this? I'm assuming that Walmart has a fairly robust process or procedures in place to make it work for them. I'm not so sure about other businesses.
Well, Representative Prox will certainly invite them at a future time. I think not today.
I thank you for saying that.
Okay. Anybody else? Okay. We are going to set this bill aside for a future hearing, and we'll address potential amendments, public testimony, maybe some more invited testimony. And I brief at ease. We will not hear SB 37 today. We will roll it on the calendar. And that concludes our business for today. Seeing no other business before the committee, we will adjourn. Let the record reflect the time is 5:03 p.m.